And now it's my honor and pleasure to introduce our first keynote speaker tonight, Cynthia Brazil. Cynthia comes to us from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Boston, where she is an associate professor of media, arts, and sciences, and where she founded and directs the Personal Robots Group at MIT's Media Lab. Cynthia received her Bachelor of Science in 1989 in Electrical Engineering and Computer Engineering from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And she did her graduate work at MIT in the Artificial Intelligence Lab. And there she received her Master's in 1993 and her Doctorate degree in 2000 in Electrical Engineering and Computer Science from MIT. It can clearly be said that Cynthia is a pioneer of social robotics and human-robot interaction. In the academic world, Cynthia is widely known for her contributions on developing personal robots that are socially intelligent and that can interact and communicate with people in a natural way. Cynthia and her students have developed numerous robotic creatures, including the well-known social robot Leonardo. I think we'll see Leonardo, but we also remember Kismet. Yeah. Other projects have explored how human-robot interaction can be applied to enhance human behavior as applied to motor learning and cognitive performance. Her more recent work investigates the impact of long-term robot learning. Do you hear me still? Yeah. And communication, quality of life, health, and educational goals. Much beyond this, Dr. Brazil is recognized as a prominent young innovator. She is a recipient of the National Academy of Engineering's Gilbreth Lecture Award, the Technology Review's TR35 Award. That sounds to me like a British sports car, by the way. And Time Magazine's Best Inventions of 2008. She has won numerous Best Paper and Best Technology Invention Awards at top academic conferences. As part of her public outreach, Cynthia and her students' work have been showcased in numerous museums and exhibitions. Her robots have been widely covered in the media, including television, radio, newspapers, magazines, documentary, and films. Cynthia is also a member of the advisory board of the Science Channel and an overseer at the Museum of Boston. Wow. Professor Brazil, we feel very honored that you came here to present your work in a keynote talk on cooperative machines coordinating minds and bodies between people and social robots. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. This is the first time I've been to this conference, so I'm very excited to have been invited to present my work to you. I'm going to assume that social robots is a little bit left of field from what you typically do, so my objective in this presentation is really to give you an overview of this field as it continues to evolve, looking at a number of research questions that are the kinds of questions that we explore in this field, as well as applications, to basically give you a nice overview. There'll be a lot of movies, so hopefully it'll be fun for you too. All right, so when we think about human-robot interaction today, especially in real-world applications, it's basically a lot of teleoperation. So these kinds of systems here, whether it's a bomb disposal robot or surgical robots and so forth, the robots in these cases are really meant to be tools that are used to do dull, dirty, dangerous sort of work at a distance or to enhance human performance. But of course, I'm here to talk to you about a very different kind of robot today. When we look at the earliest social robots, I would say they kind of came in the spirit of social stimulus. So these are robots that were really leveraging these perceptions of animacy that people would naturally anthropomorphize. Applications for things like companion animals applied to health, like the Perro Steel robot here. The little yellow robot down at the bottom is actually a tool that's used for clinical applications with children with autism. So the idea of these robots are simple robots but convey these social cues, these affective cues, emotional cues, and that leads to engagement, which can be applied to different applications. But I'm not going to talk about that today either. The kinds of robots I really want to explore with you today, I think, is where this field is going, which is really robots as partners. So how do you build robots that can actually collaborate with people in an autonomous way, understand your intents, your goals, your beliefs, and do many of the things that, of course, we take for granted when we cooperate and collaborate with each other? So what would that mean? What's the implications for the kinds of intelligence and capabilities, as well as how does that impact people when you interact with this sort of technology? And even, can you use this technology as a tool, perhaps, to gain deeper insights into how we do what we do? So a lot of different facets to this work. So socially assistive robots, this is a new term that's emerging from the field, which is basically to say, as opposed to just thinking about robots, again, as a labor technology that can do physical work, useful work and applications can actually be motivated by a robot's social properties as well. And as you'll see through this presentation, these robots can engage the social aspects of our brain in very rich and powerful ways. So when we think of robots that can motivate, engage, provide information, coach, it's a different range of applications now that we're thinking seriously in the context of social robots that we didn't maybe even 5 to 10 years ago. So socially intelligent robots, what does it mean to, again, create a robot that can relate to, understand, interact with people in these much more human-centered terms? What does it mean for social cognitive skills to be implemented on robots? In the field of robotics, this is a pretty new idea, as you can imagine. This is Kismet, who Ipke actually referred to as the first social robot on the topic of my PhD work. Today, basically, I want to kind of walk you through some projects that highlight these sort of areas of social robotics today. So endowing robots with social skills, often inspired by models of psychology and cognitive science for how we believe we do these things, adapting them to give robots the ability to do these sorts of skills. A lot of interesting work in looking at social judgments, judgments of persuasiveness, trust, credibility. As a robot gives off of these cues, much like the way people do, we can't help but form these perceptions or these, again, judgments of the other. And of course, that affects our behavior and our decision making. So understanding the consequences of social robots on human behaviors often stems from these perceptions of social judgments. Thinking about how that impacts performance, both of human behavior as well as the performance of human robot teams, is interesting. And then again, thinking about, through the process of understanding these systems, can these robots also be used as a tool to do science, to really gain deeper insight into how we do these sorts of things as well. So I'm going to start by talking about some older work, which is really a foundation for a lot of the more recent work that I'm doing now, which basically is thinking about social skills on robots and taking a lot of inspiration from developmental psychology in particular about how do these skills develop in us? Can we take insights from those ideas and theories and model them and implement them on a robot that can then approximate those capabilities? The models often get adapted, so we say they're inspired, because ultimately what we want is these robots to actually be able to do these things in real time, which often means optimization in ways that will deviate from the pure scientific theory. So one of the big themes that has inspired a lot of this early work is just the appreciation that being in a body, in a world with others that have similar bodies, that have minds that might be like yours, leads to a lot of multimodal associations, and these can bootstrap one another. So the appreciation of the self and the appearance of other agents, and then the behaviors of the self and how they relate to the behaviors and other agents. And if you have an understanding of that, can you even start to make this mental inference of the internal states of mind of the self in relation to other agents? And that's when you start getting into what I'd say the social intelligence of robots. So you're going to see this theme expressed in a number of different ways. I've been particularly interested in imitation. Now, I can tell you in the field of robotics, especially humanoid robotics, imitation has been a very well explored and studied topic when it comes to how do you teach robot new physical skills from demonstration. my interest in imitation has really been inspired, again, by developmental psychology, which is this idea of early imitation is a discovery procedure that we use in order to learn how to understand each other. So again, is it a bootstrapping method by which we can develop more sophisticated forms of social understanding? So one of the basic premises is this idea of like me, Andrew Meltzoff talks about this, having these robots almost come with an assumption that these other people that are walking around are actually like the robot, or the robot is like them, and then trying to use that dynamic in order to drive machine learning to acquire these skills and competencies. So can robots leverage imitation in an interesting way to kind of bootstrap their own social development? So one question, of course, is do people even imitate robots? And this is an informal example, but I can tell you in the work that I've done, it's actually not uncommon. So this is a little boy, Adrian. There you go.
Oh, a tea.
So the robot is babbling, and what you hear is this little boy as a way of playing with the robot and trying to relate to it. Of course, the boy is mirroring the robot's potty postures, the intonation, the sounds as well. So again, we see this quite a lot. It's a fundamental way, of course, that people have of trying to relate to and understand others. So one of the earliest works that we did really took inspiration from Meltzoff and Moore's AIM model. And I've come to learn that although this model may be controversial, it's actually a great model to implement because it's very specific in terms of what's, you know, believed to be endowed or what you can program in and what you believe is to be learned and how that process unfolds. So just as a quick review of this AIM model for early facial imitation, in infants this is intriguing because infants could do it very early on, and it's actually a cross-modal imitation ability, right? So the child sees a visual expression but then has to control its motor system in order to imitate it. So how do you learn that cross-modal mapping? So in this theory, the assumption is the infant is kind of born with this set of motor libraries, this ability to do expressions, perhaps babbling, to do them randomly. But it's actually put into, the child is put into a social situation where the caregiver or an interested adult actually takes the initiative of imitating the infant. And from these interactions, the infant may come with an understanding of how to identify eye regions and mouth regions. Once it can leverage these imitative interactions, it can learn this intermodal representation, which is the middle area here, mapping visual representation to modal representation. Once it has that motor representation, then it can do a search-to-match process on its motor system in order to do the imitation. So I'm going to show a quick video on a virtual version of one of our robots of how we implemented that process. So again, this is a virtual version of a robot Leonardo that you'll see later. There's a facial tracking system that's monitoring the regions of a person's face, where at first it's the person who actually imitates the robot. And the robot is looking at how the person's face is moving in relation to its regions and looking at contingency to record those instances where they move at the same time. So there's an implicit assumption here that people are actually proactively imitating the robot, gathering its own data set in that way, using a neural net in this case to learn this middle box, which is the intermodal representation that's taking the visual stimulus and mapping it to a motor response. The end box there is actually the motor representation of the robot, and now it can use, you know, hill climbing procedure, any sort of search to match process in order to engage in the imitative process. So that's what you're seeing there. And so this is the process by which the robot learns how to imitate a person's face, and it learns a model for the right eye region and the left eye region and the mouth, so that now when you make a facial expression, the robot imitates you. And in this case, you can even make a novel expression, which is the cocked brow in this case, and the robot's able to imitate that as well. So that's just a quick snapshot of thinking about how we can implement facial imitation on a robot. You can imagine extending a very similar paradigm to imitating body movements as well. Again, there's a very rich literature in robotics doing that using a whole host of techniques. But in the big picture, this is actually very interesting because through this process, the robot's actually acquired what you might consider to be a mirror system, so a mirror neuron-like system. And that's really intriguing to think about how that can be used to motivate other sort of social abilities as well. So one of the follow-on projects we did was to say, if we have this ability to imitate, how can we use that as a building block to promote more sophisticated or other forms of social learning? And one that I was very inspired by is social referencing. So social referencing is something that infants do. You see it kind of at its most prevalent, I guess, when their infants are around 1 year of age. But of course, we do this as adults as well. And it's this competence that's as simple as, if you're encountering a novel situation, you don't know whether it's good or bad or how to assess it, you look to others. You look to your friends. You look to trusted others to see how they're reacting to it. You adopt that appraisal as your own, and then you explore from there. So it's just a fundamental social learning process. You can imagine, as a robot, this is actually a great learning ability, because so much to a robot in the world, frankly, is very novel. So in terms of thinking about robots in the real world, you can imagine it'd be a very fundamental skill. So social referencing, in this case, this is the famous visual cliff experiment, where they would bring infants into the lab where they would see this illusion of a visual cliff, and they would put the mother on the other side. And the whole point was, a child would have this novel situation, depending on how the mother would respond, encourage them to come, or looking foreboding and having them stay would bias the child's behavior. So again, the child reading the mother's emotional expression, applying it to the situation, using that as appraisal. So again, how do we implement that on a robot? So conceptually, what we have now is the ability to mimic facial expression. So you have a person who's making an expression, you have the observed smile that's going through the vision system, through this intermodal mapping process, that's driving the facial actuators in order to produce a smile. Now, one of the things that we've built into the robot is this concept of body affect loops. So there's been psychological findings that even the act of just producing a smile or a frown, or putting your body slumped or sitting upright, induces an internal affective state within you that maps to that physical posture. So now when the robot undergoes this process of mimicking you, it's inducing within itself an affective signal, positive or negative, based on that facial limitation, and then based on the expression it makes, and that's inducing that. So now you're getting this visual stimulus of seeing what the person's doing, mimicking it, inducing that positive effect, and now learning that association. So now the robot can learn this association of this expression means this appraisal, and then it can start to apply that in a behavioral context. So I'm just going to show you a video of that in action. There's a lot of other subtlety around shared attention and things like that I'm not going to go through. But this is a robot Leonardo now in the flesh, so to speak. We need sound on this as well.
Leo, this is Big Bird.
So in this video, these puppets are novel.
Can you find Big Bird?
The robot's never seen them before. We obviously have a speech system that you can name the object. It will learn the name of it, identify it. It has,
Leo,
again, attentional processes
look
to be pointed.
Look at Big Bird, Leo.
And now the robot's picking up affect through facial
Leo,
expression, through
cool?
vocal quality. And you can see it's affecting
Leo,
the robot. I mean,
Big
he's
Bird.
Actually, you can see in his expressions, he's perking up.
Don't you think he's great?
And he's starting to, because he's sharing attention and understands that the referent of the interaction is that novel object.
Hey,
and he's
Leo,
getting this
Big
affective
Bird.
Signal. It's learning that association to map that affective signal onto that novel stimulus. And then you'll see it shape the robot's behavior, where now it wants it. That's a good thing.
Hey,
so
Leo,
you see him
Big
trying
Bird.
To take
Isn't
actions
cool?
that basically say, I want that thing, give it to me. So he reaches for it. He'll say, give it to me. So those are the gestures that you're seeing there. So the robot has now learned a positive affective appraisal from interacting with a human and sharing attention around a novel object. Of course, you can do the opposite. So now this is very controversial in audiences
Leo,
of Cookie Monster. That Leo might be learning Cookie Monster is a bad thing.
Can you find Cookie
but
Monster?
That's what we're doing here. So now it's first, here's Cookie Monster, learning the name, learning the object, associating the color with that cue, saying
Leo,
I know
Cookie Monster
that's what
is
that
very
means.
Bad.
And now Maddie is
very bad,
associating Leo. A negative affective signal with Cookie.
Monster
yeah, I know,
very,
right?
Very
yeah. With Leonardo, and you can see him start to pick up on that.
He's a scary monster.
He's showing a little distress, you know, around the Cookie Monster, and now he's like, I do not want that. Get that away from me. So,
it's okay, Leo.
You can kind of
okay
cheer
now.
Him up. It's okay, it's all right. You know, and then this is the learning part to show. You can show now the good thing, and Leo's like, ooh, I like that thing, I want it. And then you show the other item, and he's like, oh yeah, no, that's not good. You see him shy away from it. So social referencing. So now we're going to keep going. I'm going to give you one more example how we're going to keep building on this idea. So through imitation, through these sorts of processes, I've been very inspired by this idea of simulation theory. I mean, we have a robot. It has an actual body. That should be a resource that it uses to understand the world. And so, of course, the fundamental idea of simulation theory is that if the robot's able to do this mapping of self onto other, it can use its internal mechanisms for perception, decision-making, action, in order to simulate the other and make inferences based on that. So now we're pushing more into kind of theory of other mind sort of skill sets. So simulation theory, we have developed an architecture that really encapsulates this principle. So the two bands you see there, the yellow band represents the robot's own mechanisms of sensing, constructing belief states, planning goal-directed actions, and then taking motor actions to achieve them. And the inner blue ring is basically using those same systems to simulate what you see another person doing, given that you have these perspective-taking processes to understand the visual perspective of another person, the body mapping process, and so forth. So I'm going to show just a video of this in action with a fairly complex task where the robot's actually trying to manage and reason about the belief states and action states of two individuals. So here's a scenario.
In this video, the robot Leonardo demonstrates his ability to recognize the intentions of his human partners, even when their actions are based on incorrect information. Leo keeps track of objects in his environment based on data from his sensors. At the same time, Leo also models the individual perspective.
So there's a Vicon system that the robot's actually using
here,
to track your head pose to know what you're looking at when. And there's Vicon markers on these two objects. So there's chips and there's cookies and there's crates. So Leonardo is understanding that you have these two objects. You can put them in the crates. You can close the crates, but the objects are still inside. And he knows who's present and who's seeing what happens. In order to construct Leonardo's beliefs and the beliefs of others based on the situation.
This same data is presented to duplicate systems which represent the unique visual perspectives of his human partners.
So down below, those are the belief states that Leo's just keeping track of. Now that little box you see, Leo, that's actually a little contraption he has to open these two little boxes down here. So this is, you know, the classic sort of false belief manipulation. So Maddie has left the room, and while he's gone, Jesse's playing a trick on Maddie, right? So he's changing the contents of the boxes. Leo's able to track that. So he knows, Leo knows what the real state is. He knows Jesse knows what the real state is, and he knows that now Matt has an outdated belief state. So Matt now has false beliefs about the situation. Now, Leo wants to be helpful. He wants to get you the snack item you want. And so this is how he uses his little box to open up these two little boxes down here. One has chips and one has cookies. So Jesse's locking the boxes so when Matt comes back, he can't just open it up. It's going to take him a while to open it up. And because of that, Leo's got a chance to actually intervene, reason about what Matt must want, and reveal the correct item. So Matt comes back.
As Leo watches Matt reaching for the lock, he tries to infer Matt's intention by searching for an activity model that matches the observed motion and task context. Once a matching activity is found, Leo uses his model of Matt's beliefs to predict what Matt's goal might be. Then, Leo uses his own model of the true state of the world to search for a way to help Matt achieve his goal. Having correctly inferred Matt's intention, Leo assists him by opening a box connected to his control panel.
So he's reasoned about the situation based on its own task models, and now is operating this little box in order to reveal the snack item that he knows Maddie is actually after, even though his actions are incorrect in getting that item.
Thanks, Leo.
And then, of course, Jesse comes in, but Jesse has true beliefs about what's going on.
Now Jesse returns and tries to open the same box.
And so he's doing the exact same action, but of course because his beliefs are different, Leo understands his intent is different.
Jesse is aware.
And so Leo's going to take an action to help Jesse achieve what his actual goal is. So he opens the other box there.
Leo's ability to model their individual beliefs allows him to correctly.
So then he gets the, I think those are the cookies. So anyway, examples of this idea of robots that are coordinating mental states, coordinating action states with you to achieve goals. So let's keep pushing this idea a little further. This is more recent work where we've been looking at human-robot teamwork in more complex scenarios. This is actually modeled after a search and retrieve disaster response task where now there's actually two autonomous mobile humanoid robots that are trying to coordinate a complex task with a human participant in order to retrieve items in the sort of disaster zone. So we're really starting to ramp up the complexity of these tasks. This is inspired, again, by the sort of search and retrieve scenario where there's a number of items that are scattered on the floor, and your task is to find the desired set of items within a time limit and to work with the robots in order to do that. So I'll talk through the constraints of the task, which is what also motivates the teamwork and the coordination. So there are different items hidden under these little flip charts, and you can see on the screen here there's a big clock telling you very overtly this is under time pressure, you need to do this quickly. There's three items listed underneath that you're supposed to find with these robots, and there's also a button here that's meant to be an additional cognitive load task. So the participants were told people are going to want to know you're still okay, so when you see that flashing, you have to go press it. So that's, again, a measure of cognitive load. So this is the scenario. The specialization of all the teammates are such that the humanoid robots have this sensor, such as when they go to a grid, they can tell you if the desired object is in that grid. So they can be fast in that regard, even though they're slow in terms of moving. The MDS robot can actually carry things to you from a zone that's too dangerous from people to go into. And then there's also an aerial vehicle that's being operated by a Confederate that you can be kind of an eye in the sky, and they can give you an answer in terms of where a desired item might be. So there's three robots, basically. People are fast, you know, they're able to manipulate these smaller items. The robots have certain skill sets. And then there's three different zones. So in the yellow zone, that's the safe zone for the human. The robots can roam throughout the whole zone. The middle zone is you have to check with the robot if it's safe for you to enter. And then the red zone is only good for robots. So humans are restricted in how much of that space they can access. So they have to work with the robots in order to complete the task. So I'm going to play you a video of what that interaction looks like.
My name is Nexi. We will be working together to collect the items.
Hi.
Hello. My name is Maddox. We need to try to find the items as fast as we can. Are you ready?
Okay, let's go.
So these are the three items you're supposed to find, and there's four rounds of this. So every time you complete a round, you get the next set of three.
Can you check square 19?
So there's a little delay in the speech recognition. Speech recognition is notoriously difficult on robots, so that's why it's a little slow on the uptake at times.
I'll look around.
Now the robots are autonomous, so Maddox understands the overall task, and so it can initiate an interaction to find a different item. So again, these are meant to be fully collaborative systems. And they're coordinating their actions. She's making requests to the robots. The robots are checking the zones. The robots know where each other are, so they're spreading out and making sure that right zones are being checked to distribute their team power, so to speak. Here she's at the aerial operator to control that aerial robot to tell them what zone an object's in.
Yes, please.
Maddox has found one of the items, and he's going to bring it to her now. So again, it's just there's a lot of coordination going on in this task. That's the communication button for kind of cognitive load that she has to keep pressing. It happens three times during this task.
Thank you.
Okay. And so the task goes on like that. So I'm going to tell you a little bit now about the study we did. So that's considered a pretty darn complicated human-robot teaming task by today's standards. The thing we wanted to explore was the impact of the robot's nonverbal back-channeling on people's sense of stress and cognitive load on the task and team performance. So it's a very simple cue, but it's intriguing to see if as task complexity increases, if it actually has an impact on these factors. So the idea is BIDS or back channeling, where the two conditions are the robot either gives you this nonverbal cue when you make a request or ask it of something, or it doesn't. And that's the only difference between these two conditions. So I'm going to show you an example of the back channeling condition. So you make a request and the robots are tracking you, looking at you, nodding, then they'll go take the action. And in the non-back channeling condition, it's basically just that. You can make a request, It doesn't do that nonverbal behavior. It will answer the question, but it's just not giving you that sense that I'm attending to you, I'm paying attention to you, I'm acknowledging you, and we're doing this together as a team. So the hypothesis is that back-channeling, we know, is a coordination mechanism, right? And so when task complexity increases, the sense of that you are a coordinated team and you're on the same page should improve certainly the stress of the situation, but potentially even improve team performance. So the first objective was exactly that. Does this presence of back-channeling reduce stress and cognitive load on the human teammate when it's present? And then secondly, if it can reduce stress and cognitive load, you would think that team performance might also be enhanced as team complexity increases. So it's a 2x2 study. You have the channeling and back-channeling conditions, and you have low task complexity and high task complexity, where the task complexity is basically mediated by, in the low state, there's different colored flaps on those little checker, those little flap things. So in the low complexity condition, it doesn't matter what color it is, you just grab the items and you're done. In the higher complexity situation, the color matters, and you actually get more points depending on the color scheme, so you're having to pay attention to more things. So that's the complexity measure, and we validated both of those. This is just to say, you know, we recruited people from the MIT community. It's roughly, 73 participants had usable data that we used, so it's a pretty large study, robot study for a system as complex as this. And we looked at these three measures. So the stress measure was self-report on a standard questionnaire. The cognitive load measure was that button I told you about. And then the overall team performance was basically how successful were they at collecting these items? How fast could they do that? So here's what we found. Stress, as the task got more complicated, in fact, people reported having less stress when the robot did back channeling. So that's intriguing. In terms of cognitive load, so reaction time to noticing that button flashing and hitting it, much lower or noticeably lower cognitive load or faster reaction time with the back channeling than not. And then a trend that was interesting to us, and I think if we were able to run more iterations, we might have gotten statistical significance on this, but it's a trend of that the team was actually even more effective. More items tended to be gathered when the back channeling was present than without. So all in all, just intriguing to think about how even a simple gesture like this can infect, again, these social judgments, reduce stress, reduce cognitive load, which can enhance team performance, is intriguing. And of course, there's a lot more work that can be done and should be done to explore these kinds of factors. The other thing you see is in the comments, for the robots that did not do back channeling, you know, people would talk about how it doesn't seem to be paying attention to me, doesn't seem to have any common sense. I mean, there's a sense of them expecting to see this. And when it's not present, it's a little disconcerting. The flip side of this, which was also interesting, is that if the robot did do back channeling and self-report, people actually perceive the robots to be less competent, even if the team performed better. So one of the hypotheses there is that people tend to back channel more when they're more have lesser status than another person. So maybe if the robot's doing a lot of emphatic back channeling, it may be tapping into these other social perceptions. But again, it's fascinating and multifaceted area of study, but that's something we want to study more and learn about as we think about complex human-robot teaming. The last thing I want to talk about now is, so this is about, the last study was about people responding to a robot's cues. How about a robot's ability to form social judgments of someone else? So that's also intriguing, and how can you model that potentially? And the thing we wanted to look at was trust, and in the sense of trust, interpersonal trust. So can I trust you? Are you on my side? Are you going to help me or not? So this is a collaboration we did very closely with David DeSteno's lab at Northeastern and other collaborators as well. But there's two questions we had. So first is that through the literature, we know that, you know, nonverbal behaviors send us signals in terms of conveying data that we can use in terms of can I trust a person or not. But it was difficult to be able to be precise about what those cues actually are that really matter. So the first part of this study was actually trying to identify what those cues are, a specific set of cues that actually lead to perceptions of trustworthiness. And once you do that, can you learn a model, a computational model, by which the robots can use those cues in order to make judgments of trustworthiness to another person? So it's kind of a two-faceted project here. So we're talking about the ability to interpret trust in this case. So again, those two phases, first figure out what the cues are and then try to build a computational model for it. So we're talking about swift trust, or this idea of interpersonal trust that happens from a brief encounter. So it's somebody you've seen for the first time, you're not expecting to see them again, you interact for 5 minutes, and there's sort of these thin slices of social judgments, right? We make an assessment, can I trust this person or not? So based on this brief encounter, what are the cues that lead to these perceptions of trust? We tracked a lot of video data, coded a lot of things, because it could be a lot of things, it could be few things, who knows, but facial expressions, hand gestures, proxemics, a lot of things can feed into this. So in David DeSeno's lab, he brought in at Northern University undergraduates who would come in and basically do this 5-minute get to know you task. They knew there was going to be a task they would do after, but they didn't know what that task was, and they weren't allowed to talk about it. They had to just talk about things like, what's your favorite movie, what classes are you taking? And from that interaction, they're exchanging the nonverbal cues that we're recording and annotating. And then the follow-on task was actually, not surprisingly, brief interaction. Yeah. You'll see them exchanging gestures, but it's an economic game. So they're led into separate rooms, they don't see each other, they play this game called the Give Some game that I'll tell you a little bit about. That's the behavioral measure on how much they trust the other person, and then they leave without seeing each other. So that's the premise of getting the kind of empirical measure of the trust judgment, where the Give Some game is a variation on the prisoner's dilemma, where you have sets of tokens, where the tokens of yours that you keep are worth $1, but if somebody gives you their tokens, they're worth $2 to you, right? So the kind of max communal benefit is if everyone exchanges each other's tokens and everybody, both people get $8. But of course, there's a selfish payoff, which is that if you keep your tokens and they give you their tokens, then it's $12. So there's a tension there between what do you give and what do you keep. So through the game, they played this game, and we asked them these two basic questions. So how many tokens did you actually give to your partner? And also, you had to guess how many tokens you thought your partner would give to you. And of course, that's kind of your assessment of how trustworthy that is. So that's the quantifiable measure that we can use to train a model, as well as to assess whether these cues are actually have predictive power in predicting the accuracy of your trust judgment. So there were actually 4 cues that were identified that led to diminished perceptions of trust. So the more that people did these, the less you tended to trust them. And these were fairly robust cues that we used. Now you might be asking, so these are the cues, where does the robot come in? So the robot comes in because a lot of these cues are subconscious. So it's very difficult to train a human confederate to validate these cues. But you can bring in a robot in order to do these in a very controlled way. So here, this is just showing that people tended to give less money or less tokens if they saw you do the cues or if you actually did these cues more, right? So that's just showing from the empirical sense that that was the case. And then we validated with this robot. So now we had the same scenario, but we replaced one of the people with our Nexi robot. The robot was teleoperated in a back room where one person was speaking through the robot, did not know the condition, the other person was controlling the gestures, so either just expressive cues or these particular kinds of cues that are indicative of less trust, and then of course our technical graduate student person there making sure it's all running. So here's what an interaction looks like.
That's basically all I do for fun though. I don't have a lot of time.
Did you grow up in upstate New York?
Yeah, I did until I was 18 when I moved out here.
So she's doing this hand-touching behavior, and so the robot's now being controlled to mirror that gesture.
It was a really big transition, but I kind of decided that it wasn't the life that I wanted, and so I went.
You'd be surprised how natural these conversations were. There were a number of young men trying to actually flirt and ask Nexi on a date. You'd be really surprised. So here's another, so you can just see the robot a little more closely.
We all share a big open room. There are lots of cords and gadgets. So it's probably not like your house, but it's home for me. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell me about where you're from?
Well, I was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and I have a residency in Somerville right now.
Very interesting.
I've been there for the past 4 months.
Very interesting, yes. She's a good listener. All right, so you get the sense of that. So the punchline, of course, is you have these two conditions, one where the robot specifically exhibits the cues that are indicative of don't trust me versus the one where it doesn't. And, of course, what you see is that people, in fact, do trust the robot less. So this was work that was recently published in Psychological Science, and I think You'll see one of the citations down at one of the bottom of these slides. So that was phase one. So phase two now is, if we can validate these cues, can we actually now train a computational model so that the robot can actually decide if it trusts you, right? So that's a computational model of trust. So that's basically what this slide says. We have the data, of course. We know what people actually did. We know what people thought the other person would give them, and we know what they actually got. So we have all the data we need. So the crux of it is we use the support vector machine in order to train this model. I think the interesting bit here was more insight into the cues, the features that were actually necessary to get statistical significance on the performance of this. So I think this is where using the robot actually helps us gain more insight into what's potentially going on in people's behavior than you might through the straight coding of just the single individual gestures. So coded, we have the coding, of course, for all of these cues. We have them for each participant and how they overlap. We looked at those cues specifically that we identified in phase one of the project. But actually what we found that was even more predictive were clusters of those cues. So it's not just that there's a presence of each of these cues, but how the proportion of them in relation to positive and negative cues. So this was sort of additional insight that I think we gained through actually doing a feature analysis to get these models to perform well. We have that all for self, we measured it all for other, and we also looked at the difference between the two. So what we see here is the SVM model, thankfully, certainly performs better than random. It actually performs better than the a priori model, which is the most common state of always giving two tokens, so we can outperform that. And of course, the big question is, how does it do compared to people? And the bottom line is, it actually does better than people. So intriguing to think about if people are actually also applying or using these ideas of constellations of cues rather than the individual cues in order to make their perceptions of trust. And a robot can track that in much more detail and resolution, and so maybe it can be even potentially better in the sort of scenario. So that's intriguing. So the next step is we want the robot now, the robot can make an assessment of trust, but can the robot now produce the gestures to elicit the sense of trust? And can you actually create a feedback loop that if the robot wants you to trust it an appropriate amount, can it actively adjust its behavior over time to actually get you to trust it in that extent? So that's where the work is heading now. So it's all about trying to develop this production model, which is intriguing. But to kind of wrap it all up, why do these things all matter? Well, there's all kinds of robots being designed to help us in all kinds of ways where trust and these social judgments are actually really important for just acceptance and use of these technologies, right? So this robot over here is, for someone who's paralyzed, it's a feeding robot. Are you going to trust that robot to interact with you safely? That's a really interesting question, right? You're starting to see robots that are meant to work alongside people on the assembly line. So do you feel like you can depend on that robot as a teammate to get the job done? So that's another important social judgment. What does that robot have to do, both in terms of performance, but also these cues? And you can see this robot actually has a screen to convey, you know, eye expressions at least, that might help you build that sense of trust and dependability, that sense of dependability. There's robots out there. This is a commercial product that actually came out of one of my PhD students where it's a robot health coach. And so the challenge there is not just to get you to lose the weight, but to keep it off. And so this idea of building a working alliance that keeps you motivated and engaged the way a coach does to help you be more adherent and to be more successful in your weight loss program. So trust and persuasiveness is coming in that context. When you think about robots as learning companions for children, so this is another project in my lab where the robot plays a game with a young child to learn a second language. And so can the robot build a sense of social support and a sense of trust so the child will explore with the robot and treat the robot more like a peer and a learning companion to improve the child's learning outcomes? You know, this is a final project that we've done in our lab thinking about, can a robot actually persuade you to adopt safer driving behavior, you know, to not text on your phone or to be more likely to adjust your mirrors or fasten your seatbelt? So again, we're starting to see many, many, many applications of robots where their ability to bridge not only into the social-emotional realm of people, but this sense of partnership and collaboration is a really important and really intriguing theme, a very different relationship we have with a lot of our technologies today. So I'm going to start to wrap it up here. But social robots, I mean, I think one of the things that is so exciting about this field is it's not only an opportunity to invent the future. I mean, obviously in robotics, I mean, everybody wants to know what are the things good for? You know, how are we going to see them in the world? So we're creating these really innovative technologies, but in the process of trying to make them really sync up with people and really work with us and how we think and how we behave, it gives us the opportunity to really understand something about that relationship, and at times even allowing us to use these robots as a tool to learn even more about people in a scientific context as well. So it's a fascinating field, and there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of excitement around it. You know, these social skills, these social cues, these social judgments, they're all feeding into many, many applications. So I just have a setup here taken from science fiction. But we're living in this very exciting time where you're starting to see real robot systems actually start to try to do aspects of what we've only imagined in science fiction in the past. So I'm going to end there, and thank you very much. Thank you. Can we actually put the slides back up real quickly? I want to acknowledge the small army it takes to actually do this work. So this is my group. The trust work, again, was done as part of an NSF grant. David Desteno was the main PI on this, but Robert Frank and David Pizarro and Shay Faishaw were all very instrumental in making that work happen. As you can imagine, that urban madness study took a small army. We worked very closely with Pam Heise and Malte Young at Stanford University, so I want to give them a shout out as well. But again, it takes a lot of people to make this stuff work, so it's important to give credit where credit's due. Okay, thank you. All right.
So thank you, Cynthia, for this highly inspiring and refreshing lecture. It made us stand the warmth a bit easier here. Now we can have a little discussion because you speed it up a little, so there is time left. I'm very happy about that, sure. Because I can imagine that people would like to ask questions. And I would like to ask those people who pose questions to stand up so we can see them, and then a helper will bring you a microphone. And we also try to alternate questions down to the keynote side where other people have been just attending your talk. Mm-hmm. And hopefully the link will work. So, questions? Yes, Gregor.
Does it matter for how seriously the robot is taken as a partner, how reproducible its behavior is? I had a sense that now the interactiveness is much better than it was many years ago, but I wonder if observers find out that it's very reproducible, that they might recognize it's an artifact. Does that matter?
I'm having a hard time.
So essentially, do you introduce variability in how the robot behaves in interaction to create a sense that it's not a mechanical thing? Does that matter what the variability of the behavior is?
So given a set of cues, the dynamic range of those cues or the number of cues?
I mean, the early experiments that you showed, I don't remember the name of this Furby thing, that under certain interactions, the robot makes these gestures like reach to the object.
Right.
And it sometimes looked like they were quite invariant, that they would always be the same.
Right.
And that's what I'm inquiring about, whether that matters, and if you've looked into the role of variance.
Yeah, so I can tell you in general, it depends on the experiment that we want to do. So the early work you saw with Leonardo is more of a technical sort of validation versus a controlled study. In a controlled study, you probably intentionally want to have a lot of precision around what the cues are and not a lot of variability, right? So in later work, you're probably going to see a lot more consistency in the cues because we want to limit that variable in the study. I don't know of an experiment today that explicitly looks at this question of how the variability of a set of cues impacts judgments or performance. I don't think I think we're more in this stage right now of trying to understand the role of these cues in a more general sense before we really get into the more precise aspects of how much can they vary and does it matter if the cues are five cues versus two versions of the cues. I think that's all an open question at this point. Okay. But typically when we do a controlled study like that, we have a very tight control over what those cues are just because we don't want to be introducing more variables than necessary.
Thank you. There's a question from down under now. So how do we get this up? Can you? Do I have to bring the mic?
If you can hear me, yes. Actually, I don't think we have a question at the moment. So you can
okay.
So, okay, no answer necessary. Next question.
When you now decipher the codes of our trust, could robots manipulate humans, deceive them?
So, I mean, I think the answer is they can. I guess the question is, would you want to? But I think what this work is showing is, I mean, like we do, people respond to these cues even if they're exhibited by a robot, which is why when we talk about trust, we frame it as appropriate trust, because just having people trust you more isn't necessarily what you want. You want them to trust you in the right amount. In a lot of ways, right? Especially if people are unfamiliar with the robot and don't know its range of competence, having it be very upfront and honest about what it can do and not do to frame that trust within appropriate bounds, I think is a really important question for these kind of technologies.
Okay, answered. A question from back there.
If the robots were looking really like people, do you think they could pass a Turing test? Like people will take them as real people or similar to people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I can tell you from my own philosophy when I design these systems. I mean, you can tell I'm not trying to make them look human-like at all. I have this sense of authenticity of that robots are robots, and it's in fact that they're different from us and complement us that makes them so interesting. So it's more important to me that they have the synergy and they have a cognitive fit with us versus being identical to us. And I think what we're finding again and again is the robots certainly do not have to be identical to people to have people enjoy working with them, want to work with them, have positive outcomes with them. And in fact, you know, there's almost this interesting sort of companion animal psychology that we've been finding as well. So people seem to kind of view these social robots in the intersection of the kinds of interactions that you have with people, of course, which you can have with technology, but also the sort of non-judgmental aspect of companion animals. And I think optimizing that intersection is a really intriguing optimization, I think, for this field, because it's almost taking the best of all of those three worlds and creating something new that really sits at that intersection.
Okay. Okay. So go on, come on.
So the question is physical versus virtual agents?
Yes.
Yeah, so I can tell you, I mean, it's intriguing. So within the field, there's been a lot of explicit comparisons between a physical robot, a video of a real robot but somewhere else, and a 3D rendered graphical version of the robot. And what you often see is, you know, these perceptual judgments are stronger. The more real it gets, the stronger those judgments. And so one of my most favorite examples of this is a study that Brian Scazzolotti did at Yale, where he actually compared explicitly those three conditions. And the task was a book stacking task, where one of the places you're supposed to put the books was a trash can. And many, many, many more Yale students who are supposed to be pretty smart put the books in the garbage can when the robot asked them to do it, and not so much in the other conditions. So there seems to be some intriguing thing about when it gets to actual behavior, real-world behavior, robots, the more physical, the more perceived as real these robots are, the more persuasive they seem to be. And that's something that I think is, I mean, certainly worth continuing to study, but it's a theme we see again and again. So it's intriguing. I think, you know, screens have the advantage of their ubiquity. You know, so if you go to the shopping market, you can have a virtual agent on your mobile phone. You're not going to bring a robot with you, right? So there's advantages and affordances of each of these medium, and you can see these effects with these medium. And I think one of the interesting questions is, when is the robot really optimal versus a more digital representation? I think, you know, there's certainly validity on all of those technologies.
Okay, now a philosophical question again.
Yeah, thank you very much for the presentation. I want to ask, what is the underlying representation in the theory of mind task? Is it just that you couple the representation of the person, object, and the box? Or are you able to account for the fact that it is a preference, so that person, Sam or whatever, prefers object A over object B? Is there some generalization possible, or is this representation really only made for this task and this situation?
It's the system, because within the robot's basically reapplying its whole cognitive architecture in order to not only do the task itself, but reason about how you do the task. So it's comprised of a lot of separate representations, whether you talk about the belief states or the action states or the goal states. They're specialized to those different systems. So I can't say there's like a one answer, other than the representation is the framework of the robot's own architecture. It's very much an embodied cognitive approach to it. So it's how those representations have the information flow as it's simulating the other. That's how it's representing all aspects of that task. So within the belief system, it's representing the state of the boxes, but in the intention system, it's representing the state of the goal, right? So it depends which part of that architecture and what that representation is, but it's bringing them all together in order to do that task, if that makes sense.
Next question from over here.
Thank you for the great talk. And it seems in your model right now, the framework is based on certain kind of models, as you have shown. Mm. But I think in reality, I mean, the way we perceive or produce social cues are highly individualized. Mm. And if you look at animal cognition, for example, dogs can get these cues very good, but also they can react to these individualized differences depending on context and culture. Yeah. So how would you solve this problem with robots when you want to make them really social and react to different people in a different way?
Yeah, no, so I think, I mean, the answer is, when you look at where the field is going today, especially when you talk about personalization, there's a thrust now to think about through longitudinal interaction. I mean, a lot of this stuff you saw up here was like a brief encounter. They come in, they interact with the robot for 15 minutes, and they never see it again. But when you talk about personalization, now you're talking about long-term interaction, living with these robots, so they have a chance of actually learning these models. And so that's where the field is going in terms of thinking about deploying these systems in real human environments, connecting them off into the cloud so you can collect the data and update the models dynamically, so that you can actually explore these questions of personalization, which I think absolutely that's really fascinating, and that's an area certainly I'm working towards as well.
So I think now the last three questions, we started about 7 after, and so there is just time for last three questions.
When robots are collaborating with humans and with each other, is there any reason you would want to have robots socially interacting amongst themselves in the same way that they interact with humans? Or do you pretty much across the board want them to maybe just share a representation over Wi-Fi or something?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a really interesting question. I think if it's just a team of all robots, they can be sending information however, right? It can be done over Wi-Fi, assuming they have Wi-Fi. I think once you introduce humans into the system, people also need to understand what's going on between the robots. So they're a team. So how you keep the person apprised of what's going on and the belief states in the robots is also important, and as well as having the robots interact with them. So it's about just making sure the whole team is mentally synced up, is the way I would view that.
Okay. Yep. Is there another question from down under? Do we know this? Then the next question goes here.
I got intrigued by your use of support vector machines in your computational model. Now, there are two questions here. What was the reason for support vector machines instead of other machine learning things? You could go for lots of things in Weka, for example. Yep. And another thing, if you could use, could you use your work in more psychologically realistic models of human competence, mm-hmm. we should probably replace support vector machines with something which mm-hmm. is has lower performance, but it's more, well, psychologically realistic. Yeah. Do you see any direction towards
that? So I think it depends on what your goal is. So I can tell you, I mean, we ended up with support vector machines in this presentation because we actually tried a bunch of different techniques and we're getting the best performance, as well as the feature set. There was a, I didn't go into it, but there's a lot of effort in trying to figure out the cues that were going to give us the right performance. So it was a big exploration, but that gave us the best performance out of a variety. So that's the answer why support vector machines. I think in terms of whether we should replace those models with more human-like models, I think just depends on what your objective is. So in my work, ultimately, I'm interested in having robots do these things in real time and effectively. I'm less concerned, maybe, if they do it exactly the way people do, as long as it's understandable to people. So as long as the compatibility is there, the underlying, how authentic is it, you know, to how people do it, is less of a concern of mine, but certainly for someone else, that's what the research would be about. So there's just many ways, I think, to view advancements in this area.
Thank you.
Big hand.